We're going to take a break from the book of Exodus this morning, and everybody's getting excited. Let's go ahead and turn to Psalm 119, if you would, please. Now everybody's getting scared. Psalm 119, we're just going to be looking at one stanza this morning from this incredible psalm. Psalm 119, we're going to be looking at the Tet stanza, verses 65 down through 72. The Bible says, "You have dealt well with your servant, O Lord, according to your word. Teach me good judgment and knowledge, for I believe in your commandments. Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. You are good, and you do good. Teach me your statutes. The insolent smear me with lies, but with my whole heart I keep your precepts. Their heart is unfeeling like fat, but I delight in your law. It is good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn your statutes. The law of your mouth is better to me than thousands of gold and silver pieces."
15 years ago, we were all brought to a shocking reality, especially as the next morning, these were the newspapers that greeted us on our doorsteps. If you were alive that day, you do not forget September 11th. For any American who was alive that day, the stories of 9/11 never fail to bring a lump to the throat, a tear to the eye, a pause to the soul. Few moments in the history of our nation are as defining as that one beautiful, terrible, memorable fall morning, a morning in which the landscape of life as we knew it was forever changed. What started as a promising, cloudless September morning soon became a haunting, dusty, charred reality. You remember where you were that morning. I remember that we had gotten done with our summer activities. We had just pushed through one more Sunday, had taken Monday off. I was going in late Tuesday morning, getting ready. All of a sudden, the phone rings, and one of the guys that I'd been working through a Bible study with said, "Hey, turn your radio on. Two planes have run into the World Trade Centers. They're going to fall. We're being invaded by terrorists. I mean, the whole nation, they're taking over airplanes and using them as bombs." And I thought, yeah, right. I thought he was pulling a joke on me. He was kind of that kind of guy. I said, "Oh, right, yeah, tell me another one." No, turn your radio on. Okay, I will. And sure enough, just the gravity in a moment, in an instant. The pictures of that day, you saw them. You were glued to the television as much as I was throughout the entire day, watching, wondering. Somebody said they're going to fall. Can they make it? Seeing the entire downtown of New York City filled with smoke on what was otherwise a cloudless September day. I don't remember it being as perfectly beautiful as it was that day. I think I remember it being so still because not an airplane was in sight after about 10:30 in the morning. You saw the Pentagon in flames. The hope was to bring our nation to its knees through what is inconceivable. The first one, everybody thought, how terrible. What an accident. What a foolhardy accident. By the time the second plane hit, everybody knew it was more than an accident. And in fact, it did bring a nation to its knees. We remember that day. That was just 15 years ago today. Seems like an eternity to go. So much time has taken place. But it's just 15 short years ago. As a nation, we've determined that we will never forget that day. But a question comes to mind. I think it's an obvious question. Or at least it's an appropriate question. If it was that bad, why would we go to all the trouble to try to remember it? If in fact it was so terrible, so horrible, so hauntingly real, why would we go to all the trouble to remember 9/11, and to do it corporately, to do it nationally, to do it together as a people of God in God's house. Why would we take time in our worship of God to pause and remember a national event such as 9/11? I'm glad that you asked. Because in the midst of the darkness, there was still light. Again, these pictures you've seen before. But these pictures are every bit a part of the story. Because in the midst of the dust and the ashes, there was light that was shining. You've seen this picture, and some have superimposed the flag at Iwo Jima being raised. Two different generations. In the midst of darkness, God always shines a light. I'd like to tell you a couple stories as I look back and tried to read some stories of heroes on that day. The first is of a 24-year-old named Wells Crowther. Just a few minutes after United Airlines Flight 175 struck the South Tower of the World Trade Center, 24-year-old Wells Crowther called his mother and calmly left a voicemail. "Mom, it's Wells. I want you to know I'm okay." Crowther's was an equities trader at Sandler O'Neill and Partners on the 104th floor. But after that call, the man, who was a volunteer firefighter in his teens, made his way down to the 78th floor sky lobby and became a hero to strangers, known only as the man in the red bandana. Amid the smoke, the chaos, and the debris, Crowther helped injured and disoriented office workers to safety, risking his own life in the process. Though they couldn't see much through the haze, those he saved recalled a tall figure wearing a red bandana to shield his lungs and his mouth. He'd come down to the 78th floor lobby, an alcove in the building with express elevators meant to speed up trips to the ground floor. It's what's been described as a strong, authoritative voice. Crowther directed survivors to the stairway, encouraged them to help others, while he himself carried an injured woman on his back down 15 floors to safety, then made his way back up to help others. "Everyone who can stand, stand now," Crowther told survivors while directing them to a stairway exit. "If you can help others, do so. He's definitely my guardian angel. No ifs, ands, or buts, because without him, we would be sitting there waiting till the building came down," survivor Ling Young told CNN. Crowther is credited with saving at least a dozen, perhaps 18 people that day. Crowther's body was later recovered alongside firefighters in a stairwell, heading back up the tower with the jaws of life to rescue others. I'd like to tell you about two retired Marines. While the planes were hitting the World Trade Center, 27-year-old Jason Thomas was dropping off his daughter at his mother-in-law's on Long Island. When Thomas heard what had transpired, he changed into the Marine Corps uniform that he had sitting in his trunk, a former sergeant who'd been out of the Corps for a year, then sped toward Manhattan. "Someone needed help. It didn't matter who," Thomas told AP News. "I didn't even have a plan. But I have all this training as a Marine, and all I could think was, my city is in need." Around the same time, in Wilton, Connecticut, Dave Carnes, working in his office at Deloitte, watching the attack unfold on TV, said, "We're at war." Before telling his boss he might not be back for a while, the former Marine staff sergeant went, got a haircut, changed into his Marine uniform, drove toward New York City at 120 miles an hour. Once both Marines reached the collapsed towers, the site now covered in ash and debris, they began searching for survivors, but first they found each other. They had little gear with them besides flashlights and a military entrenching tool. Along with other first responders, the pair climbed over the dangerous field of metal, concrete, and dust, calling out, "United States Marines, if you can hear us, yell or tap." When they reached a depression in the rubble of what had been the South Tower, he said, "I thought I heard someone, so I yelled down." They replied back that they were New York Port Authority police officers. They asked us not to leave them. Carnes told Thomas to get to a high point to direct rescuers to the site, then called his wife and sister on his cell phone and told them on the phone to give the New York police his location. The two officers, William Gemeno and John McLaughlin, were in the main concourse between the towers when the South Tower began to fall. But they made it into a freight elevator before the collapse. They were alive but seriously injured, trapped approximately 20 feet below the surface. According to the USA Today, Once they heard the voices of the Marines, they began to shout 813, 813, the code for an officer down. After they were located amid the unstable mountain of debris, it took rescue workers roughly 3 hours to dig out Jimeno and another 8 hours to reach McLaughlin, who was buried farther down. An exhausted Thomas, who never gave his first name, left the site after Jimeno was rescued but returned to Ground Zero for the next 2.5 weeks to help. His identity was a mystery until the 2006 film by Oliver Stone, the World Trade Center, chronicled the rescue of the officers, and Thomas emerged from the shadows. Carnes, on the other hand, left after Jimeno came up but helped at the site for another 9 days. Afterward, he returned to Connecticut and went to his reserve center and reenlisted. Later served 2 tours of duty in Iraq. One other story that you may or may not be familiar with is that of Major Heather Penny. This one was an interesting one. We all remember the F-16s that were scrambled that day. All the airplanes pulled out of the sky. A couple F-16s sent up to patrol the skies. Listen to this. With scant detail of what was happening and no time to do pre-flight checklists, 2 DC Air National Guard pilots quickly scrambled to intercept United 93 after 2 other planes had already hit the World Trade Center. Except there was a twist. They were unarmed. In the days before September 11th, there were no armed aircraft standing guard in Washington, D.C., ready to scramble at the first sign of trouble. And with a Boeing 757 aircraft speeding in the direction of Washington, D.C., Penny and her commanding officer, Colonel Mark Sasseville, couldn't wait the dozens of minutes it was going to take to properly arm their respective jets. "We had to protect the airspace any way we could," Heather Penny recalled to the Washington Post in 2011. "We wouldn't be shooting it down. We would be ramming the aircraft. I would essentially be a kamikaze pilot." Before they took off, Penny and Sasseville both planned to ram the aircraft with their F-16s. Instead, the passengers on United 93 made the intercept unnecessary, ultimately fighting back against the hijackers and downing the aircraft into a Pennsylvania field 20 minutes outside of Washington. Wow, huh? Those kind of stories are incredible. They came to the surface in the midst of a terribly, terribly, terribly dark day. But why are they light? They're light because they showcase goodness. In the midst of evil, it showcases others who were thinking of somebody besides themselves, willing to pay the ultimate sacrifice on behalf of somebody else. That's biblical. You look at 1 John 3, and he says, "By this we know love. He laid down his life for us, and we must lay down our lives for others." That's goodness. That's essential goodness. Whether or not these people were saved, they were living biblically. That's why we remember. In the midst of these horrid days, in the midst of tragedy, in the midst of darkness, we must remember because for God's people, the bad is only the means to the greater good. You know what? God used that moment to surface some acts of bravery, kindness, and so on, and inspire a nation and get our attention and take our minds off of the money-making mode that the Twin Towers represented in downtown Manhattan and start thinking a little bit more about each other and the responsibility that we have not to self to get all that I can, but to give and to give myself in the service of others. Psalm 119, verses 65 through 72 is our text for the morning. And I just simply want you to see what we've focused on already. For God's people, the bad is only the means to the greater good. I want us to see 5 truths that emerge from this text this morning. The first is this: we must confess God's ways to be good. Look at that first verse, verse 65. "You have dealt well with your servant," the psalmist says. Though introductory, this confession is also a summary. Goodness is the theme of this stanza. Beginning each of the verses throughout Psalm 119, you're familiar with the fact that this is an acrostic psalm. It goes through the Hebrew alphabet. That's why at the beginning of Psalm 119, you have the first eight verses, and above it, it has the Hebrew letter transliterated, Aleph. The next section is Beit, then Gimel, then Dalet. We're in the middle of the alphabet when we come to Tet here at verse 65. That means that all of the next eight verses under this title of Tet follow that letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and every verse begins with a word that starts with the letter Tet. In five of these eight verses, the word that begins the verse is the word Tov. It's the word for good or goodness. And at the very beginning and the very front of this stanza, he says, good you have done with regard to your servant. He puts it at the front. It's a noun. It's not as the ESV has here, you have dealt well, as though it were an adverb. It's good you have done with regard to your servant. It's a noun. It's a thing. It's something that he has accomplished. The word good begins five of the eight verses, but it's actually employed six different times in these eight verses. The focus on this verse is the fronted noun good. It's more than just that God has done well, but goodness is what God has done. Goodness is what God has accomplished with regard to his servant. It implies that the result is characterized by the commodity. Good has come. Because good has been worked. As a result of the goodness that God has worked in, goodness has worked out. Well, we saw that at least for a while as a nation, as we were beginning to work together. The thing is, we forget so quickly, don't we? But I want you to take the focus off this morning from just 9/11. I want you to look back at your life. I want you to look at a particularly difficult moment. One of those seasons where you were stretched, you were pulled, you were crushed, you were crowded. You were forced to bear a burden not of your own choosing, and you detested the entire endurance of it. But when it was all said and done, you could look back on it and say, you know what? Thank God for the difficulty. That's where the psalmist is at. He said, it was crushing. It was debilitating. It was the source of what I thought was my demise. But when push comes to shove, when the end is seen, I must confess that God is good in what he does. Though to our ears it may seem distant, the relationship that the psalmist has with God is a relationship that's intensely personal. You have done well. You have performed good with regard to your servant. We hear the term servant and we think slave. We think distant. We think somebody who's remote and distant from the one to whom he speaks. But actually the opposite is true. The idea of your servant implies one who has immediate access to the master's presence. Not everybody has access to the master, but the servant does. It also implies one who enjoys all the benefits of the master's status. When you think of Abraham calling out to his servant to go kill the fatted calf because three strangers have come into his midst, immediately the servant goes and performs the task. But remember, he's wearing robes that are provided for him by Master Abraham. He's a part of God in the flesh coming to visit Master Abraham. He's a part of bringing food to serve God and angels in the presence of his Master Abraham. All that belongs to Abraham is part of the resources that this one gets to enjoy. He gets to spend time in the tents. He gets to enjoy the food provided by. He gets to hear the songs. He gets to hear the stories. He gets to be a part of his master's life. And that's the whole idea. My God, my master, I'm your servant. you've dealt well with me. He uses the covenant term for him. You have dealt well with your servant, O Lord. A covenant term. God reveals himself as Yahweh as he's about to bring his people out of Egypt. We've been looking at that for a long time now. It's the name that God gives to his people, reveals to them. They didn't give it to him. He gave it to them. He entrusted his name to them. In fact, he places his name on them. He calls them to take up his name. The relationship that this one has with regard to this master is a very personal, it's an intimate relationship. I want us to see also that the stakes are high for God's servant, but the stakes are even higher for God. For God's servant, there's the question of his welfare. God, good has come from the good that you've done. There's the question of his welfare. I was worried in the midst of it. I felt crushed. I felt despised. I felt near death. But you've brought good out of it. But for God, there's the question of his character. If God did not perform good, especially with regard to his servants, could God, in fact, be good? If God wasn't concerned for the welfare of his servant, if God is not concerned to perform good on behalf of those who belong to him, in what way is God good? This is the theological question of theodicy. If God is good, then why is there bad? The simplest answer is found in the mouth of one of God's servants, Joseph. You meant it for evil against me, you wicked, free-willed agents. But my God, who is sovereign and gracious, meant it for good. You meant evil, God meant good. Same thing, but God's able to take the bad and turn it into something that works his purposes. But note what he says there in that 65th verse. You've dealt well with your servant, O Lord, according to your word. If God did not perform good to his servants, especially when that he said he would, then not only would God passively lack goodness, but he would actively possess badness. He would be a liar. If God, who says, I will work out all things together for good for those who love me, for those who are called according to his purpose, if God doesn't do it, he lies. And he cannot be good if he doesn't keep his word. Are you in the midst of something that's pressing you this morning? Are you in the midst of something that's hurting? Are you in the midst of something that makes you feel that perhaps your master has forgotten about your welfare? You must hold on to his promise that he will do you good. Because at stake is something bigger than your welfare. What's at stake is the character of your God. If God won't do you good, he's not good, because he promised that he would. God doesn't passively lack goodness, and he will never actively possess badness. He keeps his word to his servants. This promise is especially bound up in the revelation of God's name. We've looked at the passage several times back in Exodus 34, verse 6, where God declares his name to Moses. He says, I am Yahweh, a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. God's steadfast love is on the author's mind. If you look back to verse 64, the earth is full of your steadfast love, O Lord. He's just talked about it. He's just written about it. He's just penned it. This is what's on his mind as he thinks of God's goodness and his promise of goodness to his people. Number two, we must connect God's good ways to God's good character. We've kind of mentioned that already, but look down at verse 68. You are good, and you do good. Here's something that may have escaped our notice. But God goes so far as to equate his glory with his goodness. Back there, and we're going to look at it in a few weeks, but as the children of Israel reject God and his commandments, and they build the calf, the golden calf, and God judges, condemns his people, Moses comes down the mount and breaks the Ten Commandments, showing that the covenant's been broken. God says, I can't go with you anymore. And Moses is pleading with God to go with them still. And he says, this is what makes us different from all other nations on earth, that you are with us. You've just told us you would be in the tabernacle. God, you must go with us. Then he makes this request of God. God, please let me come into your presence once more and let me behold your glory. Show me your glory. The very next verse, God says, I will make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim before you my name. Show me your glory. I will, Moses. Here's my glory. My glory is my goodness. My goodness is my glory. Let me define for you my goodness. Let me reveal to you what my goodness looks like. A God who's merciful and gracious. A God who is slow to anger. A God who has love that is steadfast in its kindness towards my people. A God who is ever faithful, and though everything changes, I'm God, and I won't change. What we find is that all that God is finds expression in all that God does. David, again, in Psalm chapter 18, verse 30, says, this God, his way is perfect. He's a perfect God, and everything he does, everything he chooses to do, is absolutely perfect because it comes from a God who himself is perfection. How can a perfect God do something that's not good, that's not right, that's not wise, that's not kind, that's not perfect? All that God is finds expression in all that God does. And the psalmist at this point highlights this one aspect of God's holiness, differentness, otherness. He says, God, you are good, and everything that comes from you, all your hand finds to perform, is good. However, God's ways are not always immediately discerned through his good acts. Isaiah chapter 55, verses 8 and 9 says this. God is speaking to his people. He says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. You might not think so. It may not be evident to you right away. Your ways are one way. My ways follow a different path. But my ways are better. My ways are higher. So much higher, in fact, let me give you a picture. Earth, the heavens. You can't even begin to reach, to stretch, to comprehend how immense my ways are. Though you see them, you cannot necessarily discern them. Psalm chapter 95, verses 8 through 10, God speaking to his children says this, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as at the day at Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test. They put me to the proof, though they had seen my works. For 40 years I loathed that generation, and I said, there are people who go astray in their heart because they've not known my ways. Did the children of Israel know the goodness of God's works? Well, absolutely. He turned the lights on for them in the midst of the darkness back in Egypt. He's the one who kept all of their cattle alive when all the Egyptian cattle were dead. He's the one who opened up the sea so that they could walk through it on dry ground. He's the one who closed the sea on all of their enemies so that they were without enemies in the wilderness. He's the one who provided for them manna every morning except Saturday. Did they know the goodness of God's works? Absolutely. But they wanted to control him like a genie who would work for them and do their beck and call and perform goodness on their terms. God says, that's not how I operate. My goodness doesn't look like the goodness you require of me. It is good nonetheless, though you may not discern it. That's why in Psalm 103, verse 7, he says, he made known his ways to Moses, while the children of Israel only saw his works, his acts. They wanted more good works. Moses wanted more good from his God, whatever it looked like. That's where we've got to get. We must confess all of God's ways are good. And we must connect all of God's ways to all of God's good character. I want us to see thirdly this morning that we must connect God's good ways and his good character to our bad times. Look at verse 71. It is good for me that I was, what's the next word? Afflicted. Is that your testimony this morning? It is good that I was afflicted. God's goodness is not solely displayed in the circumstances I enjoy. This does not speak of trials that are light, easy, superficial, or trite. Afflicted. Afflicted. I looked at all the different translations that you would be familiar with. Every one of them has the term afflicted, whether it's the NIV, the NET, the Holman Christian Standard Bible. Every Bible has afflicted at this point. What does this word affliction mean? It means a trial that cuts to the very core of one's being. Listen to how it's defined. The word means this, to be brought low, to be degraded, to be humiliated. Well, those are pretty bad. Okay, if we didn't get it yet, to be made wretched. Wow, that's pretty bad. Do you get what's happening to the psalmist at this point? He says, my life was turned upside down. All of the security that was in it, all of the hope, all of the laughter, all of the joy was turned over, dumped out, shaken to bits, and I was thrown down in the dust and left there to die. That's my life. Watered up, thrown away. God, that's where I found myself. And he says, you know what? Today, I'm thankful that it happened. What's wrong with this guy? What's wrong with this guy is he knows a God who knows how to take the dust and the ashes and breathe into it the breath of life and bring from the ashes his will. What an amazing God. And what a blessed man to discover the ways of his God. It was good for me that I was afflicted. We may get some clue as to what these afflictions included in verses 68 and 69. The insolent smear me with lies. Their heart is unfeeling like fat. They have greasy hearts. The idea is they're gross. They're thick. I think we had some chicken broth in our fridge the other day. And it sat in the fridge past its usability date. So I took it out to dispose of it yesterday. And I went to dump it out, and all of the liquid stuff fell out of the jar. But there was a ring of stuff on top that kind of went up against the edge and just kind of stuck there. All it did was mess up the side of the jar. You go to wash that bugger out, you take your rag, and it just kind of slides over it. It's greasy. It's fat. It's gross. The idea is their hearts are unable to have any sensitivity because they're clogged. It's like they got clogged arteries. What are they clogged by? Clogged like fat or with fat. The idea is they're clogged up with all of the prosperity they enjoy. They're clogged up with all of the security that they feel themselves to have, with all of their self-righteousness, with all of their self-possessions, with all of their self-assuredness. God, I don't have any of that anymore. Thanks to the fact that you humiliated me. Thanks to the fact that you brought me low. I can't have that anymore. He says, these folks have smeared over my life with lies. If you've ever been lied about your character in particular, you know how badly that hurts. The psalmist here says, God, it was in the midst of this that I'm thankful for what you brought me to. God's goodness isn't just displayed in the circumstances that I enjoy, but it's manifest also in the circumstances that change me. You see what he says there? In verse 71, it was good for me that I was afflicted so that I might learn. The idea of learning in this verse, teaching up in verse 66, teaching again down in verse 68, teaching, learning, learning, teaching. The idea is to have something not just recited for you so that you can quote it out of your head, but something that's worked in, worked in, worked in, worked into your heart. It's those scales that you have to do on the violin or on the piano or on the cello or on the whatever instrument you've done. Why in the world do I have to do scales? I just want to play the fun stuff. You can't do the fun stuff until you learn what the notes are. So you do these stupid scales in your sleep. Why do you have to do the math facts when you're in third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade? Because when you're doing other math, you don't have to stop to think, what is 3 times 7? It's 22. I'm kidding, it's 21. All right? You run into problems if those don't become a part of who you are. And David says this, or whoever the psalmist is at this point, we assume it's David, but he says this, you have made your ways a part of who I am. That's why I'm thankful you brought me low. It was good for me, because now, whether I like it or not, it's a part of the way I think. It's a part of what I am. You've taught me your statutes. Remember what he calls himself up there in verse 65? You have done good to whom? Your servant. I am your servant. The word that he uses down here in verse 71, statutes, has the idea of one who is the lawgiver, the one who lays down the rules for. He's like the senator who lays out the rules for the community, or he's the master of the house who lays down the rules for the house. As long as you're under this roof, here's the rules we play by. As long as you're my servant in my courts, here's how we play the game. Here's how we do life together. And so he says, you know what? It was important that as God's servant that I learned the ways of my master. Now here's the thing. Up in verse 68, he says, God is good, therefore he does good. You know what the request is at this point? God, would you transform me inside so that I'm good? So that on the outside, I can perform the goodness that you require? That's what he says. God, I'm thankful that you've brought me so low that you've allowed me to change, that you've worked to change so that I can reflect you. We must connect God's good ways and good character to our bad times. Number four, we must confess our ways to be bad. It's not my circumstances that are the ugliest thing in my life. The ugliest thing in my life is me. Take your hand, stick it in the air. Take your right hand, stick it in the air. The ugliest thing in my life is me. Point at yourself, not at your neighbor. The ugliest thing in my life is me. Do you believe that? No, you don't. You think the ugliest thing in your life is sitting next to you. Maybe not in the seat next to you, but... or maybe they're not in this building, but... the ugliest thing in your life isn't any other person. It isn't even your circumstances. The ugliest thing in your life is you. That's why the Apostle Paul says, with all sobriety, he says, I believe that in me dwells no what? Good thing. Jesus says, apart from me, you can do not very much, I like to say. Apart from God, I can't do very much. No, no. Apart from me, you can do nothing. You're really not convinced of that. But you know what? Now, God, that you've brought me so low, I really, really believe that apart from you, I can't do anything. We must confess our ways to be bad. Look back up at verse 67. Before I was afflicted, what did I do? I went astray. You're familiar with the hymn written by Robert Robinson, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. We get down to that third stanza, we sing this. Oh, to grace, how great a debtor, daily I'm constrained to be. Let thy goodness, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Why? Because I'm prone to wander, Lord. I feel it. I'm prone to leave the God I love. So here's my heart. Take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. I want you to go back in this psalm, back to verse 8. As David begins this psalm, he says, the general rule is, in verse 1, blessed are those who walk in the law of the Lord. Blessed are those who seek His testimonies and seek Him with the whole heart. He says, oh, that my ways would be one of those who would be blessed in verse 5. So in verse 8, he says, I will keep God's statutes. I'm going to do it. But what's the last part of verse 8? God, I'm going to do it. But the only way I can do it is if you help me. I want you to go down to the very last verse in this psalm, 176. God, I'm going to keep your word. I'm going to keep it in front of me. I'm going to obey it. Verse 176. I have gone astray like a lost sheep. Seek your servant, because I don't forget your commandments. Wait a minute. I thought back in verse 8 he was going to keep God's ways. He wasn't going to wander. You know what? We're prone to wander. Our ways are bad. Now, I like how one writer says this. He points this out. I wouldn't have caught this. But straying has been the subject of a plea back in verse 10. Oh God, let me not wander from your commandments. In verse 21, it speaks of a curse. Those who wander from God's ways are cursed. Okay. Though there the verb was saga. Here the verb is sagag. While the meaning of these two verbs overlaps their form, they are apparently not simply synonyms. Sagag, the verb that's used here in verse 67, before I was afflicted, I went sagag, I went astray. Sagag has the idea of straying accidentally. The one who is cursed is the one who strays on purpose. The one who on purpose deliberately rebels and goes away from God. You know what? Well, I may not shake my fist in God's face. I fear Him too much for that. I love Him too much for that. Yet the reality is, I don't trust Him enough to obey Him. I don't take Him seriously enough to obey Him consistently. So, I've gone astray. By God's gracious discipline, He now knows that not meaning not to wander is not enough. You ever had been at the table and somebody knocks over their glass of milk or something like that? Like, why did you do that? Well, I didn't mean to. Right? You ever heard those words? I didn't mean to. Stop. Whether you meant to or not, where is the milk? Right. Okay? So, is not meaning to a good excuse? No, because milk still ends on the floor even though I don't mean to. Okay? I didn't mean to wander, but the end effect is I still did wander. Look how he ends the verse. Verse 67, before I was afflicted, I went astray. But now, what do? I make sure that I don't wander. I make sure that I don't spill the milk. You have my attention now in such a way that I'm watching where my feet go. I'm paying attention to what path my feet are walking. It's not good enough that I didn't mean to. I still did. What I have to do and what God's brought me to that place in my life is where now I'm watching so that I don't, no matter what, go out of the right path. The fifth truth that I want us to see this morning is this. We must submit to God's good ways. Verse 66. Teach me good judgment and knowledge. It's a request. Again, Tov is at the very beginning of this. It's a request for experiential knowledge that results in a skillful discernment. It has the idea of Psalm 34, verse 8. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. In fact, the word taste is really the word that ESV translates judgment. Teach me the good taste and the goodness of knowledge. God, let me experientially know your goodness. Let me experientially know how good it is to make the right choices in life, to keep my feet on the right path in life, so that I don't have to get down the path and look back and say, oops, sorry, help. God, let me experientially know how good you are and how good are your ways. The acquisition of this experiential knowledge and this skillful discernment is what he says is in itself good. When I get this knowledge of God's goodness, when I get a knowledge of God's goodness that helps me discern what's good and what's evil, what's helpful, what's beneficial, what's a threat, I'm in a place where I've been benefited by God. The request is to teach me the goodness of discernment and knowledge. And he makes a statement. I believe in your commandments. The second part of the verse forms the basis of the first part. Because I believe in your commandments, teach me the goodness of discernment and knowledge. Because I believe, teach me. But you see what he says? Teach me because I do what to your commandments? For now I believe in your commandments. You think of the word commandments. What word would you expect to go with commandments? Your commandments. Carissa, what would you put there? I obey. That's what I would put. God's commandments require obedience. Okay. Why would he put the word believe? Mark, do this. Okay, I believe that. What? are you okay inside there? Commandments are not necessarily to be believed, but to be obeyed. However, they cannot be obeyed from the heart if they are not believed to be what? True or good, right? Goodness is at the heart of this whole stanza. God, I believe you have my goodness at heart. I really do. I believe all your ways are good because I really believe that your character is always and only ever good. So you've given me commands that I'm going to perform because I believe in your commands. What do I believe about your commands? That they're good. And they're good for? Are they good for God? I'm like the servant who's sitting there holding the reed. Faster. God's commands aren't for his benefit, folks. God's commands are for whose benefit? They're for your benefit. Do you believe that? God, teach me more of your word because I actually believe that your commandments are for my benefit. I believe that. They're for my good. Through this submission, the psalmist has redefined his values. Verse 67, he says, "Now I keep your word." That is, I intentionally guard my way by being careful with the focus of my eyes. Verse 69, with my whole heart, I keep your precepts. That is, I have a full and glad obedience that comes from the inside out. He says in verse 70, I delight in your law. Charles Spurgeon says our delights are a better test of our own character than anything else. As a man's heart is, so is the man. I delight in your law. Spurgeon says again, when law becomes delight, obedience becomes bliss. I like that. Verse 71, I have learned your statutes. That is, I've gained the skillful application of the ways of the people of God. I look like God's people. In fact, look down at the very last verse in this stanza, verse 72. The law of your mouth is more good to me than thousands of gold and silver pieces. If, in fact, this was David who wrote this, David was no stranger to gold and to silver. When David passes the baton to Solomon and he says, "Son, I want you to build God's temple. And besides everything that I've laid aside for God's temple, I have some personal things that I'd like to give God. To the tune of 3,000 talents of gold and 7,000 talents of silver." Well, very good. Okay, a talent is 75 pounds. 3,000 times 75 pounds at today's gold prices? Just in gold, David, out of his own treasures, gives toward the building of God's temple $300 million. Just out of his silver, he gives to him $10 million. $300 million and $10 million. And David says, "You know what? God, all of that is like nothing compared to the fact that I can have your word. The words, the law of your mouth. Because God, it's like you're whispering in my ear, telling me which way to go. You're bringing light into my life in the midst of my darkness." For God's people, the bad is only the means of the greater good, which is this: to be conformed in my own life to God's goodness. Can you look back over your life and see that to be the case? Where God's brought you low and left you there for a time so that you would learn what good means. 15 years ago, those two towers were standing right at the edge, symbolizing all of the prosperity, wealth, security of a great nation. In a single day, that glory, that beauty was transformed, and they're gone. But it's good for us to remember that even in the dark, God brings light, because these are God's promises. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good. For those who are called according to God's purpose. That's a promise. I'd like to close with this verse. I have it in the King James. I like the way it has it. "I had fainted unless I had believed to see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living." In your life, do you bank on God being good? Or do you complain about the fact that His goodness doesn't meet up to your requirements? It's important for us to remember bad events, because bad events help us to understand a little bit about what God's goodness actually looks like. God is able to bring good out of bad. The terrible thing is, as a nation, we've forgotten the lessons that Psalm 119 just told us. In order for us to understand the goodness of God, we need to conform to God's goodness. Because the more we forget, the more He has to remind us. It's a harsh discipline, but it's a good discipline. Let's pray.